Hello and welcome to the Beer Business Finance Podcast, where we combine beer with finance to help you create delicious profits in your beer business. I'm your host, Kerry Shumway. I'm a certified public accountant, a former CFO for a beer distributor, and I love numbers. This podcast will provide you with useful financial guidance that you can implement right away in your beer business to make more money. In addition to this podcast, please visit beerbusinessfinance.com. Here you'll find free tools and resources, information on upcoming courses, and you can sign up to receive the weekly Beer Business Finance newsletter for free. Each week, we cover a specific financial topic to help you improve the financial results in your beer business. Let's get started. Today on the podcast, we hear from RJ Martucci from PKF O'Connor Davies Accountants and Advisors. RJ and I talk about wholesaler consolidation, mergers and acquisitions, and the state of the union in the beer industry. We talk about the main reasons why wholesalers buy, why they sell, and what motivates those decisions. So for now, please enjoy this conversation with RJ Martucci from PKF O'Connor Davies. Just a quick note, and we'll be right back to the podcast. I want to let you know about the Beer Business Finance Association. This is a network of financial pros just like you looking to improve financial results, increase profitability, connect with your peers, and share best practices. Our mission is to help your beer business improve financial results through transformational financial training, support, and networking with your peers. If you'd like to learn more, please go to bbfassociation.org or simply email me at kary@beerbusinessfinance.com. That's kary@beerbusinessfinance.com. Hey, RJ, welcome back to the podcast.
Kerry, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to round two.
I'm looking forward to it as well. So for folks who are not familiar with you or your firm, why don't you give them a little bit of background?
All right, sounds good. So my name's RJ Martucci. I'm a partner with the food and beverage practice within PKF O'Connor Davies. We're a top 25 firm with offices all up and down the East Coast and ever expanding. So we can't wait to see what markets we move into next. Our practice itself has about 50 plus years of beverage distributor experience on top of the more recent beverage manufacturing, as well as, food distribution and manufacturing as well. But my expertise is on the bev side. So that's why we're here today to kind of continue all our fun conversations.
That's awesome. Did you say 50 years?
Yes. Yeah. So we actually started with our first beverage distributor client in 1970, 71.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's been a great relationship. Still got, we're still through onto the third and roughly fourth generation coming in.
There you go. Well, you've seen a lot. That's fantastic.
Yeah. I wish I could say myself I've seen a lot, but I've learned a lot from, some of my predecessors who are great and talented people themselves.
That's the best way to do it. Good. Yep. So today we're going to talk about mergers and acquisitions, consolidation in the beer industry, specifically for distributors. So maybe tee us up with, what is the state of the union, or what, from your perspective, like, what's the state of M&A in the beer industry, and what's that landscape look like?
Yeah. So I think broadly speaking, if you just look at how economically the country is doing, I think that obviously transpires into the beverage industry. So there's a lot of uncertainty, brand uncertainty, labor uncertainty. So you think about all the recent developments we've been seeing with unions potentially striking, unions continuing to stay on strike, brand transitions, things of that sort. There's a lot of uncertainty. So I think this is a great and relevant time to have this conversation. Certainly, if you just flip back through all the BBD emails from the last like two and a half months, there's about five or six major acquisitions that have happened already. Commonplace besides OMAC being, involved in all these deals, a lot of AB houses are transferring hands.
It's a lot going on out there.
Yeah.
What do you think is, that's, the uncertainty, of course. What else are you seeing is like driving sellers to want to sell? Like what's going on? What are their primary motivations that you've seen?
Yeah. I think the number one thing is a lack of succession planning. I think you get distributors are deep family-oriented businesses. And as you stretch those generations out, you bring in, you kind of get further away from the original founder of the business. So you start to bring in a lot more family tension. And you also start to pull those next generations further away from the business itself. You have the, I guess, consider it the current generation operating things, you know, people in their, you know, 50s or 60s and possibly into their 70s, you know, have been doing this their entire life, you know, 30, 40, 50 years at this point. And the knowledge that they've amassed is not always the easiest to transfer. And so I think there's a discrepancy of if that next generation is ready, if they're committed to the long haul of, you know, really keeping the business going and seeing it through, you know, the peaks and valleys of, you know, this, the nature of the beast in the beverage industry. So I think that's really what's pushing a lot of sellers to transact.
It's also tough too, because these are by and large family businesses, right? And you have that dynamic where maybe it's, you know, great great grandfather, and then it's, and it goes on and on, and before you know it, your family is now this cousins and second cousins. You've got all these in there, and that can get complicated fast, I would imagine.
Absolutely, it becomes more a trip to the therapist's office rather than an actual you know, sitting at a lawyer's table and trying to just hammer out a deal, because there are those things of, you know, for instance, who might be in the business and who might not be in the business, and how do we split everything equally? You know, like you said, when you get into the cousins and the second cousins and, you know, in-laws and people marrying into the family, you start to really create this whirlwind of positions and emotions toward the business that I think can make it very difficult to get through an emotional transaction such as selling a family business.
Absolutely. We love our families, and it can be challenging.
I always joke about my sister. I have an older sister who's 3 years older than me, and I always said if I ever ran for politics, I would immediately be down one vote because she would just want to make it harder for me.
That's her job. Right? Let's shift to from the perspective of the buyers. Now, we could all speculate on what their motivations are, but what are you seeing from your perspective? Why are people out there wanting to buy another wholesaler business?
I would say it's the business itself is a great model, for the simple fact is that if hedge funds and private equity are trying to get in, you know, it's a lucrative, you know, very enriching business to be in. I think that's one factor, but I think when you get down to people who are already in the industry continuing to acquire, it's territory. It's grow or die kind of mentality. And so when you have even non-contiguous territory, if you have someone in the same, you know, distributor house as you, it's an easy transition to, you know, getting systems connected. People are already in the network of things. So that's an easy thing. But territory, because, you know, the more territory you can cover, the more products you have in your house to sell. That's kind of how the increase in revenue comes about.
Right.
I mean, you've seen, right, with there's such a shift in product preferences, and there's a new NA out every day, a new energy drink out every day. And the hardest part is to find the brands that people want to consistently buy. So if that's through, you know, acquisition, if it's, you know, expanded territory, that maybe those brands will come about after you get the territory. It's all opportunity. And I see from what we've been reading, it's that 5 million and over tier that are going after kind of the 2 million and under. And you get into like the Mocklers that, you know, that are in the teens and things like that. But they're finding very strategic acquisitions to make that just further enhance their footprint.
Okay. So there's a lot of people and professionals involved with the deal, right? You've got accountants and lawyers and potentially brokers and whatnot, everyone sort of helping guide the process. So when you're working with clients, let's start with maybe a client that's looking to sell.
Yep.
We can switch it around too, but what does that process look like? How do you guide them through that?
Yeah. So I think from the selling process, it's a little bit easier, right? Because we're looking to generate the biggest return on the investment for our clients, right? So if that's the largest sale price, a lot of people are focused on that. Our value comes into the transaction development with regard to strategy and how we can make it the most tax effective. Because a lot of the times that businesses sell, it usually is with the intention of living off that value. And how do we make that dollar stretch after taxes, right? So minimizing that tax impact. Our firm is connected with, we have about three major investment partners that we work with. So it's bringing them in to say, okay, you know, like, let's come up with a financial plan, how we can get, you know, certain dollars liquid for them to be able to live, you know, day to day, the way their lifestyle has always been, as well as then, you know, insulate that principal that's going into investments for them to live on for, you know, for a long time, you know, be able to keep involved. Because the one thing I notice is a lot of our distributor clients are so heavily involved in their community, and they're very generous, both with product as well as their own financial resources. So it's that continuing that giving keeps them kind of connected to the community. So how we can help them strategize their giving and things like that, even if it's bringing our private foundation team in and helping them set up a private foundation and you know, develop the kind of the purpose of what they want to do with that foundation. We've seen private foundations that get set up almost towards the benefit of the employees. So it's almost like setting up scholarships that are available to employees or employees' children that the family made available. So it's a great, yeah, these private foundations have great benefits to them as well.
Nice. Yeah, from a seller's perspective, I mean, if all goes well, it's a giant windfall, and that's great. But to your point, you know, there's a number of considerations other than just, hey, here's a big pile of money. It's like, what are the tax implications of that? Because there's lots of different things I'm sure you guys can help them with. And then how do you make that money last? Because for many sellers, this is it. You know, this is the payday. And then you know, there's nothing, not a whole lot more coming. How do we make that, you know, last?
Right. And it becomes one of those things where even if you want to continue on, say, 2-3 year, not really earnout period, but, you know, kind of a hang around clause in a sense, you know, you'll get a moderate salary out of it, but you're not going to be taking the distributions you might be able to draw out. You're not going to get the benefits and the perks that you would allow yourself as the owner. So there is a strategy with that, making sure that every dollar counts. What a lot of people think tend to forget about is we have all these things we're selling. But when it comes down to like assets, a lot of the time they're all depreciated. So it's turning that money back around, right? Because we have gains on that. We have the, you know, the gains in goodwill and the gains on the brand rights. Thankfully, those are typically capital gains. So there's, you know, limits in that regard. But yeah, there's a lot that can go wrong if the deal is not structured properly.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Is we generally think, okay, I want to sell, I want to find some buyers, I want to, you know, drive up the value to the extent that I can, take care of my people, and then, you know, kind of get out clean. But then there's all these other considerations that can make a huge. When do you typically come in and do that type of analysis, let's say for a seller, so that they can understand? Because there's a lot of things happening like on a parallel track. Like, hey, we're trying to negotiate the deal, we're doing this, we're doing that. When do you come in as far as, hey, let's talk about the deal structure and how the tax implications of this?
So a lot of the time with our clients that we are assisting them through the sale, we go into it with having that kind of analysis done. And we'll do it kind of across maybe three or four tiers, right? So here's if we sell at X, this is what we're going to be looking at. If we sell at Y, and so on, so that we give them kind of a good idea of what the cash outflow will be based on where you sell. So that if they can live with a certain number, then we know we can kind of negotiate into that range, right? If we know it has to be something else and we're not getting that traction, then we kind of have to start to have difficult conversations, right? Is it might not ever be the value you think it is, or the value someone else tells you it is. But if you be good with this number, this is what, this is what the taxes are. This is what, will be yours to kind of walk away with. And that's when we'll say, hey, let's look at a long-term financial plan. Let's bring in the investors, investment advisors, and see what you can do with that money and where that brings you out to. Because a lot of times, like you could expect there's a narrowing of the vision when it gets into that selling, because you people just become focused on the number and not really opening it up to see, okay, if I can get this number, I can get this out of it. I pay my taxes, I move on, and my lifestyle is my lifestyle. I'm good with that. So it's kind of just like pulling off the blinders to help them through that process.
Introduce some reality into the situation. Unfortunately, the taxes have got to be paid, and the structure of the deal is going to make a difference. So that's from a seller. Like, so now from a buyer's perspective, how do you tend to work with and guide them?
So the first thing right off the bat is kind of getting a sense of the target itself, what the cash flow is, what the value is, more or less. Then we do a lot of communications with either the current lender that our client is with, or we will reach out to other lenders in the space that we have great connections with and kind of get a sense of like, what loan value are you guys looking at? What are the financial covenants that you guys are looking at? Kind of getting a roundabout idea of who might be able to fund the acquisition, what we'd be looking at as far as future minimum obligation coverage, what kind of cash flow is going to be needed to service the debt. What sort of requirements are going to be made on them? One thing we always try to shy away from is that audit aspect, right? Is if we can get a loan that doesn't require the annual audit being done, that's a dollar savings to the client itself. It tends to be, easily tens of thousands of dollars in professional fees saved for them. So certainly we want to look at that. But I think the number one thing we want to touch is how much of our current operations is going to need to be leveraged to acquire that new operation. And that's what we've seen, I would say, leading into 22, was the premiums were high, and a lot of the times you were going to have to dip into, the excess profits of your current operation to cash flow the new operation, right? There just wasn't enough cash flow to cover the premium that was being more or less requested at top multiples,
What are you seeing? Absolutely. And what are you seeing for, and this can be give me a range, give me an approximation, but like loan to value and the covenants. You had mentioned that. Like, and I know this could vary dramatically based on, what the deal looks like and who the players are, but what do you tend to see in the loan to value?
So, I would say from a coverage perspective, a lot of the times banks are comfortable kind of in like I would say a 6 times low, loan to equity value of the purchaser. And certainly a lot of the times they'll structure the interest rates or other fees associated with it, that the more the equity converts and the loan comes down, you'll kind of drop down on the interest rates, right? Because it's less risky in that regard, because you're putting more value behind that acquisition. So the most of the time, the covenants we're dealing with are, fixed charge coverage ratio, and I would say, EBITDA, they're usually looking for kind of a 1.25 times the debt service for that year.
So it's pretty, that's kind of what I was familiar with, I guess.
Yeah, and there hasn't been much
Yeah.
movement in that regard. So, what we've seen kind of 6, 7 years ago, as things were really kind of hitting the height, versus today, it's not really, moved off that position.
Okay. When you're looking at the valuation, we always joke it's worth whatever somebody will pay for it, but
Exactly.
how do you guide your clients, or how you advise people in terms of that approach? Because I know like traditional valuation methods can do this approach and that approach. There's all these different approaches. We always seem to come back to discounted cash flow, discounted free cash flow. And is that still, maybe just take us through the methodology and then what kind of multiples, a range of multiples that you might be seeing.
Yeah, so I would say that any deal that can be paid off using the free cash flow within a 7 to 12 year period, because a lot of times, most of the times, you're getting a loan that's 10 to 15 years for an acquisition of this type. So if you can be below that 15-year payback, I think it's a reasonable approach, especially when you consider what the value add is for having that additional territory, those additional brands, and so on. It's when it gets to the point where your 12 to 15-year payback, and you're kind of, like I said, dipping into operations in the predecessor entity, that things start to say, I don't think the deal itself is a good deal, because dollar wise it's a stretch. And if you I don't know if we'll ever see another Bud Light again, but if you have something like that, and you've already kind of maxed your borrowing, that really can set you back with regard to now really cutting expenses and things of that sort of your other entity in order to make that deal work. So the shorter the payback, clearly the better the deal. But the deeper the pockets are always the better position to be arguing from when it comes to purchasing.
Right, gotcha. What, tell me, let's shift gears and talk a little bit about brokers. So what's your feeling on brokers using them? Maybe not your feeling necessarily, but what's your experience with deals involving them or not? Or maybe what's your guidance or advice for people thinking about that?
I think it's kind of a double-edged sword, just like working with certain, other professionals, right? Certain accounting teams, certain legal teams. Everyone's kind of got their own approach. We've historically had good experiences with some bad experiences. Those bad experiences have usually come from, I wouldn't say a deal in bad faith, but an approach from bad faith, where a purchaser was kind of already identified, and the broker was used kind of just to stalk to see if they could bring the price up without really giving any sort of consideration to any other bidders in the process. So that's kind of been the, we've had those experiences that have not been pleasant, because a lot of people put time and effort into developing what the projections look like, hammering out a deal number, because you know, we're going back and forth with clients, beating up the numbers, looking how we can work with the current business to make a deal work. And you spend, you know, several weeks doing that. You put a bid in and it really never mattered. It was just kind of to test the waters to see that the market would pay roundabout what someone had already offered. But we've had great experiences with brokers as well, working from the same side of the table. They're very well connected within the approval layer, I would say. So they kind of have that inroad into your Molson Coors brass, your AB brass, as far as getting a deal done and getting the proper sign-offs and things of that sort. So it's been good like that, where it kind of has sped the process up.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. They can. Yeah. So eyes wide open when you go in, just ask the right questions. And
it's just like teaming up with, you know, any other professional advisor. Understand that there are some that will completely deal with you in good faith because, you know, they're committed to you as far as, you know, doing the best for you. Mm-hmm. Versus, you know, possibly playing both sides. That's usually the worst, where you have any sort of advisor that's working with both the seller and the buyer, you know, because you have that conflict.
Absolutely. Well, tell us a little bit about, let's talk a little bit about sort of making ready for a sale or for, you know, to become an acquirer. And then maybe dovetail it into the due diligence phase. Like, yep. What are the types of things that you recommend people kind of look at in advance of, you know, actively looking to buy or sell? Like, what do you typically see, like, you know, housekeeping items or numbers or corporate docs? You know, what's usually a mess out there?
Yeah. So I would say the number one thing we always look at is that, you know, trailing 3-year look. Because that will be a true indicator of things that you can take the projections that are being provided. Because obviously, if you're a buyer, the seller's coming to you saying, this is how much it's worth. Look, here's the projections. This is how much we're going to sell. These are our operating costs. You can expect this. You want to look at that trailing period, right? Those 3 to 5 years, to see, were they doing the things that they said in the projections? Because that's the one thing that always kind of seemed unusual to me, is that if we could sell our products for a dollar more, or we could incur less in expenses, in operating expenses, why wouldn't they be already doing that? Right? Like, why would they have left that money on the table unless it's just not there? Right? It doesn't make sense. But if you look in the trailing few years and where they're at today, were they making strategic changes to position themselves in better light to sell? Because that's what I would tell our clients who are thinking about selling, is let's have the conversation maybe 3 to 5 years before they're really ready to pull the trigger. Because like we said, it's psychological selling, as well as it's getting the business in order, right? So we have that 3 to 5 year window to say, okay, let's start making decisions that really show the results as what they can be. Because then when we say, you know, here are our projections based on recent results, right? It's not, here's projections based on projected results. It's, you're giving that buyer, hey, you know, these are reasonable expectations for you when it comes to this business, versus, you know, do we think we can bring it up a dollar? Do we think we can cut costs here, cut costs there? You know, so I think the strategic approach to selling is certainly being aggressive in managing revenues and expenses going into the process.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Right. Cause then you're saying, here's reliable figures from the last few years of what we've been able to do. And you, Mr. Seller, can come in. And if you think that because you have contiguous territory, you might be able to bring our area up maybe based on what you're selling your products in your areas, hey, that's all a benefit to you. Because we had a clients of ours who had an opportunity to buy some territory that was contiguous. And the sole reason they were like, this is a good deal, is because they knew that day one they could walk in, adjust the pricing in that new territory, and it would not be a problem because they were already selling those same products in their contiguous territory for that price. So, it's one of those like, hey, go in and do it then.
Easy money. That's nice.
Yep.
Yeah, I think there's that's a good exercise too. Even if you're at the point where everybody's always thinking about buying or selling, right? It's like always in your mind. And
Yeah.
if you were to run that, whether you're simply just thinking about it, it's just this little thought that floats away. To do that exercise in your business, I think would be interesting. 3 to 5 year back, what's your look back? If you were to pitch this now, what would be the things that you might spin to a prospective seller? This is from the obviously coming from a buyer. And then if there's that extra dollar here or a dollar there, is that something you could actually do in your business? Because maybe it is,
Right.
maybe you just need that little mental push. So that's one. And then the other is, synergies are kind of, they can be a real thing, right? I mean, one plus one equals three. That's the whole idea. And maybe what a strategic buyer is looking to do, is roll up that volume and not have to add the same amount of costs. And so those are legit as well. Is that what you guys do? You get into some of that modeling for prospective buyers or sellers?
Definitely, definitely. So we do many different iterations of financial statement projections, balance sheet, income statement, cash flow, across a number of scenarios where we look at all the different operating costs and see what those could, how they could be impacted. Right. So we had a client that acquired contiguous territories, a separate client, and we were running through how many drivers would we need, how many warehouses would we need if we consolidated the warehouses, because they were not that far apart, maybe 45 minutes to an hour. If we consolidated that, do we have the footprint to handle it, first of all, in our current warehouse? How does that impact the lives of the drivers, right? Where if they live in that area we just acquired, now they got to come into our area to pick up their truck, load up their truck, and then go back down or over to wherever they're from. What is that from a lifestyle perspective? Right? What sort of premium might we need to layer in for some of them? That's the one side, right? What's the other side? How do we make sure that our current drivers and our current employees don't go, hey, whoa, like, how are you going to turn around and offer this guy that and keep me here? Because now I got, maybe new territory or expanded territory or other products to carry. So those are other things that we look at when we get into those projections, is not only bringing new people in, but bringing our current staff. Maybe they are underpaid in relevance to those new staff. So we can't bring new staff down because that's a moral issue, in the sense of the morale side of things. But then, we have to incur some costs that we wouldn't have normally thought about because we have employees right now at certain rates, but we have to adjust to make sure everyone's kind of level playing field. So, yeah.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of moving pieces. So you'll do sort of the modeling and the analysis for those types of, scenarios. And then, hopefully the deal gets done, the value's agreed to, purchase and sale signed, close the deal. And now you're on the other side of it. And the buyer is now going to actually implement. Do you work with buyers sort of post-closing on, hey, here's what we thought we would do. How do we actually go out and make that happen?
Yeah, I mean, if we have if we have a client who's selling, if the buyer has a deep firm that they're working with, a lot of the times you kind of just have that separation where it's with our sellers, it's what's the next thing? Where what are we going to do now? If we get into those, like I said, private foundation conversations, investment banking, other ideas that they want to do for the rest of their life. But when we have clients who then buy, then it's the, okay, when are we going to do a cutoff? What do we need to do with regard to ensuring that trial balances convert over and data converts over and no AR accounts get screwed up in the process, right? Because we had one that closed on a Friday, and just the trickling in of receipts and everything through the weekend into Monday, because just naturally how bank transactions were processed, it became a nightmare when it came to the true up, the 90-day true up of things.
Yes.
So a lot of the times we like to kind of stay involved just to ensure all the data migrates over and our opening balances are right. We can touch the ending one day of two separate businesses and the opening of another day with just one business unit. I think signing the papers is when really things kick off from a deep accounting perspective.
Absolutely. All that work that you thought, now I'm done. Well, you're really just kind of beginning, aren't you?
Oh yeah. Especially if your client purchases, because then it's all right, let's make sure everything transfers over properly. Let's, if we do quarterly work or monthly work, it's like, okay, how is that going to change the financials? Do we have to, work with like an Encompass or a VIP to make sure that the GL codes line up so that they're mapped together? The banking auto withdrawals and all that other stuff is updated. So yeah, there's a lot more after the close that is fun to deal with.
That's you says you. That
yeah. Doesn't sound like much fun, but I will tell you it's not, because I've run into this is probably one of my favorite stories. I ran into the accounts receivable manager for a client in the grocery store about a week and a half after a merger. And this was like, it was like 7 o'clock, and I ran into her and I was talking to her and I'm like, so how are you doing? She's like, I'm getting groceries for the first time in 2 weeks. I've worked every day. How do you think I'm doing? I'm like, that's all I need to hear.
Man, it's tough. Yeah. Well, RJ, this has been great. I really appreciate all this information, giving people a lot to think about. Somebody's listening to this. They want to connect with you, learn more about what your firm does.
Yeah.
The best way for them to do that.
So if they go to www.pkfod.com, that's the firm's website. If you go into the industries and things like that, check out food and beverage. And then if you drill down the food and beverage to the beverage and distribution things, you'll find my profile, my biography, my contact information. Can reach out that way. But I'm sure there's a lot more meat on this bone that you and I can get around three in for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And are you on LinkedIn, or is there a way folks, if they wanted to connect with you that way?
Yep. I am on LinkedIn. Let's see. I'd have to, cause that the problem being Ralph Martucci, which is my legal name. I always wonder like, how do I have it set up? Is it under RJ or is it under Ralph, from a profile perspective? But yeah, it's RJ Martucci LinkedIn. So feel free to connect there. Definitely available for conversations that way too.
That's awesome. RJ, thanks so much for the time.
Carrie, thank you as well. And I appreciate the invitation again, and look forward to continuing our conversations for sure.
Thank you for listening to the Beer Business Finance Podcast, where we combine beer with finance so that you can improve financial results in your beer distribution business. For more resources, tools, guides, and online courses, please visit beerbusinessfinance.com. And don't forget to sign up for the free weekly Beer Finance newsletter. Until next time, get out there and improve financial results in your beer business today.